It must nearly be Christmas, because here is Season 11, Episode 41 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday the 18th of December, and we're going to be discussing what's been going on in the news and in the community. I'm Martin, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello, hello.
Hello, you well?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Good. And Mark.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, before we get into anything else, Mark,
yes,
I do believe you're allowed a second bite at the cherry at the potential collapse of the UK government. How is government collapse watch going?
I believe that all votes have been postponed until next month. So it's still there for now. Theresa May survived her no confidence vote.
Right, okay.
So unfortunately...
So no points for you, yeah, by the close of the podcast then. Sucks to be you. What else have you been doing?
I have been playing Super Smash Bros. Ultimate.
While the government is falling, you're playing Nintendo Switch games.
Fiddling while Rome burns.
Good.
And how is it? What is it? I have a terrible admission. I have no idea what Smash Bros. Is, or Super Smash Bros. Or Super Smash Bros. Ultimate.
Super Smash Bros. Is a series of Nintendo games whereby it's basically a beat 'em up, but it's featuring various video game characters. Initially, it was various Nintendo characters. So you'd play like Mario and Pikachu and Kirby and Donkey Kong facing off against each other. But nowadays, it's like people from all sorts of video games. So you've got some people from like Metal Gear Solid and Final Fantasy as well in there, as well as like all the Nintendo games.
And is it a beat 'em up sort of Street Fighter style?
It's a bit less structured than that. So rather than having like two fighters with you know, a bunch of secret special moves which you have to work out and a bar of health, it's like you're on a stage which is modeled on one of the games, and you try and make each other take some damage, and then after you've taken a certain amount of damage, you become very easy to knock off the stage, and so then you've got to try and basically knock each other off by using more powerful moves. And everyone has like a set of basic moves and a set of special moves, which are specific to their character, that all use exactly the same controls. So even though there's like 70 different characters, you don't have to memorize or look up a big list of like secret key combinations. It's just like you can pick up pretty much any character and use
them. Sound good.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And so, yeah, I spent the weekend playing that with some friends on the Nintendo Switch.
Now then, what have you been up to?
I have upgraded two home servers, HP micro servers, from Ubuntu 16.04 to Ubuntu 18.04.
Oh, right. Was that painless?
Completely.
And what do these servers do? Anything clever?
Not really. One of them does backups. So it's like it uses R snapshot to back up loads of remote machines, like, well, the podcast host server and my own VPS from Bitfolk and my laptop and a few other bits and bobs back up to this central location. It's quite important. And there's a few other, I tend to use it as a bit of a dumping ground, really. Like, It's kind of use it a bit like a NAS. It's got a Samba share on it, and I just throw stuff on it when I need to keep stuff somewhere that isn't going to go away. It's what I've also put Sync Thing on it, so I have Sync Thing on all my laptops and everything, but also have it on the server, so I've got a copy on the server.
Yes, yeah, I've been moving to Sync Thing again. I'm very happy with it now, I have to say.
Yeah, more on that later, I think.
Oh right, okay then. Mm. So moving on. And now it's time for our roundup from the news. And the first story I saw in the news this week was that the Discord store will support Linux.
Ooh.
So what's the Discord store?
So a little while ago, some months ago, back in the summer maybe earlier in the year, Discord, which is the popular chat client, more or less used by sort of the gaming community, although you see it used by some, you know, open source projects as well, announced that they were going to create a game store within their, you know, their chat environment, akin to sort of itch.io or Steam. Yeah. And when they announced it, it was Windows only. But they have confirmed this week in some other information around what their, you know, store costs are going to be, that they will, in fact, be supporting Linux. And they quote, good news. Everything we built for the store actually works great on macOS and Linux. A lot of our devs use those platforms internally. We just wanted to focus on releasing Windows first to make sure everything works. And to be honest, that's where most of our users are. We will definitely bring things to all platforms.
I like the way they say everything we built for the store works great on these other platforms, because it's a giant web app. It's an Electron app.
It's an Electron application. Oh, right.
Hardly surprising.
Yes. This doesn't mean all of the games work great on macOS and Linux.
I shouldn't think so.
No. But it is interesting that they're building a, I think I mentioned this back when we first noted this, they're building a web, a game store in their chat client, and Steam have been working on a better chat client in their web store.
Yeah.
So they're both converging towards each other. And there's been a lot of discussion about the cuts that various stores are taking, and the fact that Epic Store, the people who make Fortnite, are taking 12% versus the Steam's 30%. And this all kicked off because Discord are going to take, what, 10%?
10%, yeah.
Interesting.
Starting in the new year, and they will allow developers to self-publish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if that does, in the long run, drive Steam down. Mm-hmm. With other competitors in the market.
Mind you, I would just like to note the remarks about it being an Electron app, a web app. Steam is essentially based on exactly the same technologies. That uses Chromium embedded frameworks, which is sort of
the
competing product.
Yes, it's mostly built on SDL, though.
Well, yes, but the way it's all presented is through CEF.
Yeah.
Right, so what did you find in the news?
So MIPS is going open source. What's MIPS? I hear you cry. It's that other processor architecture that nobody ever talks about. Like, people talk about x86 and AMD and ARM, and those kind of things get a lot of cachet in the news. And more recently, people have been talking about RISC-V. Mm-hmm. But MIPS has been around for a very long time as a chip architecture. And the company Wave Computing, who purchased the MIPS processor technology back in June, have announced this week that they plan to open source MIPS.
And so this is the processor architecture referring to, right?
Yes. So they're going to have this thing called the MIPS Open Program that will give people free access to most recent designs. So this is going forward. I don't think it will necessarily retrospectively say all their previous like generations of chips will be open source, but moving forward, I think, mm-hmm. is what they're aiming for. But it's funny because MIPS is used in quite low-end things like routers and mm-hmm. or routers and gateway devices and
right. disk controllers.
Yeah, really super low power. And TVs as well. There's a lot of TVs that have MIPS processors that drive the on-screen display and the menus and all that kind of stuff, which is often why they're a bit slow, because they're seen as kind of like the redheaded stepchild to ARM. Like, you know, you see the old comedy sketch where there's the three guys and I look down on him and he looks up to me. Well, if you think of like Intel being the big one and ARM being the medium sized one and MIPS being the lowest one, even though MIPS and ARM have like billions of devices out in the field, that's the way it feels like mm-hmm. that Intel looked down on ARM and ARM looks down on MIPS. I'm sure that's not really the case, but like you can picture that. But anyway, it's going to be open source, which is interesting. People will be able to create designs of their own processors based on the MIPS intellectual property, which is interesting. Maybe a bit late. Maybe they should have done this a few years ago. But
I wonder if this means that this current generation of architecture is actually going to, you know, it's not what MIPS or Wave Computing are interested in, and they have something new in stage left.
Who knows? We'll have to wait and see.
Mark?
Well, there was a story which was in the rumour mill when we recorded the last show, and we decided not to include it. But since then, it's actually been officially confirmed that Microsoft will be basing future versions of its Edge web browser on Chromium.
Yeah, the internet's gone a bit on fire on this, hasn't it?
Yeah. So this means that Edge as a browser will still exist, but the Edge HTML rendering engine is going to be retired. And Microsoft will be contributing upstream to Chromium and then releasing a browser which is basically Chromium plus Microsoft's tweaks and presumably Windows integrations in branding and so on, in the same way that Google releases Chrome based on Chromium.
Mm. And Brave did this recently as well. They switched to Chromium. Yeah. From
they were originally based on a fork of Electron called Muon, and they've switched to Chromium as well. And then Opera did a couple of years ago, I think. They switched to Blink, didn't they?
Yeah, which is the rendering engine used by Chromium.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as a web developer, this gives me mixed reactions, because on the one hand, hooray, don't need to support Edge anymore. On the other hand, boo, now there's fewer independent implementations of web standards, because the way that the web is supposed to work is that, you know, the W3C has been the body that that creates web standards, and that and those standards get implemented in multiple browsers, which is how they're an open standard. And if there's fewer browsers around, then this system doesn't work as well. So what we're seeing now is that basically 90% of the web is based on Chromium, which is largely controlled by Google, and there's a sort of little bit of Firefox, which, you know, Mozilla for the market share do make a lot of noise about, which is good, but without more browsers and more rendering engines to have the standards implemented in, then we end up with a monoculture where basically rather than having an open standards process, the standards process becomes you know, whoever gets commits in the Chromium issue tracker rather than like a more open process. So it could mean that, you know, Google and Microsoft between them, basically, or probably more Google than Microsoft, control the web to their commercial ends rather than it being a more open system. That's the, you know, the doom and gloom view of this.
Time will tell.
Yeah.
I think we've got time for one more, Alan.
Yeah, just a cheeky one to slip in there. Calabra Online Developer Edition, commonly known as CODE, C-O-D-E, 4.0 release candidate 1 is out. So this is Calabra's web-enabled version of LibreOffice, basically, that allows you to create and edit Office documents in a web browser. And there are versions available to download, so you can try this out. It's been going for a little while, but it's starting to get some better UI and some more features, a better mobile interface, so it could potentially become a viable alternative to Google Docs and Office 365.
Yeah, I think Simon Phipps was talking about this at OddCamp, wasn't
he? When you say talking about it, he wouldn't shut up about it. Yeah, you're right.
So have either of you tried installing this?
No, because I read the scan instructions and I realized that there wasn't enough for me to go on.
So I previously, before this release candidate was released, did try installing it on my server and I didn't get very far.
Right, that was my experience.
There were some Debian packages, and I installed some Debian packages, and then it told me to set up a load of reverse proxy stuff, and none of that seemed to work. And at which point I gave up because, yeah, as you say, scant instructions. So I'm hoping that as this matures, there will be a more streamlined installation process.
I'm glad you mentioned that because there is. Download appliances like VMs for KVM, VirtualBox, and VMware and ESXi.
Okay.
So you can just boot it up in a VM and not have to worry about installing all that extra faff.
Excellent.
So you can try it out. So yeah, it's worth a go.
And there's integration with Nextcloud as well. Once you've got it running, you can point Nextcloud at your Calabra Online endpoint and it should integrate.
Okay. So does that mean you get first class sort of collaborative editing now within
Nextcloud? I mean, it is aimed at the early adopter and the enthusiast for the moment. So it's not something that you would roll out in production. I'm sure Calabra would argue that they're for the stable releases, that's exactly what you should do, and you should pay them money to roll that stuff out because that supports the development of the online editor and to some extent LibreOffice as well, no doubt. So yeah, I think it's worth people trying this out and, you know, reporting bugs and you know, testing, pushing at the edges of this, but it is a release candidate, which should mean it, you know, it should be relatively stable. It should work. The major features should be there. But I think it's worth people trying it out because it's, you know, it has the potential to be an open source, a decent open source alternative to all these silos where people are locking all their documents up like Google Docs. Yeah, you can absolutely take ownership and host them in your Nextcloud or wherever.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, as time marches on, it used to be the traditional desktop office suite was the sort of defining feature that, you know, users needed. And I think people are getting around to the idea that they do those things through a browser these days. And we probably need something that competes with the desktop office suite, you know, that can be self-hosted or hosted by small organizations.
You've got to remember, not knock the collaborative side of it. Like, you know, it's very common, obviously, for many people to create documents locally and they stay on their hard drive and then they get shared or published or whatever. But it's also very common in the development of documents for them to be iterated on by multiple people at the same time. You know, we do this at work all day, every day, like collaborate on documents. Half my browser tabs are, you know, Google Docs.
And wow, so that's what, 200?
yes, half on this computer. Yeah, so it's certainly something that people are moving to. And, you know, I realize there are some people out there who say, not me, I use local office editors all the time. And, there is obviously a space for those, and those applications still exist. This just brings it to the web, to the new method where people could potentially have browser-only computers like Chromebooks that, you know, you only use a browser and you can still get on and do your job, which is great.
Yeah. Right, that's the end of the news. Let's move on to some community news. So here we are, some community news and events. Mark.
First up, Robert Ansell has blogged about GIFs in GNOME. Ooh. So it turns out there were some issues in the library used to render GIFs in, I think it's GDK PixBuff, that meant that certain cases of GIFs, in particular when they're animated, were using enormous amounts of RAM. And so he's basically written a little bit about why this was, and in the process digs into some interesting stuff about the innards of GIFs and how they're constructed and how they've sort of been, let's say, misused abused over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fascinating because this stemmed from...
This is our fault.
Yeah. A snap that was in the Snap Store that had an animated GIF as a screenshot, which is perfectly okay. But when it rendered in GNOME software, someone reported a bug that the memory usage climbed up considerably high. And it was a confluence of a number of factors, but it had Robert, who works on GNOME software, looking at how GIFs are constructed, which I think is quite interesting. How you have to be able to switch personality when you're working on free software and look at, you know, all the different libraries that you're consuming. You can't just be myopic and focus on one thing. And Robert's quite willing to pick up these interesting things and look at GIFs when actually he's maintaining a storefront application, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been advising that, you know, people use animated GIFs in their store pages to make them look a bit more interesting, which sort of highlighted this issue. And also, Robert's a lovely guy, and I got the impression he may have been a little bit miffed with me when he found that one of my GIFs I'd published for a snap on the store wasn't a GIF at all. It was called GIF, and it was actually a WebM. So I wasn't contributing to helping solve this problem in any way. So sorry about that, Robert, and thank you for sorting this all out. Alan.
I wrote a blog post, and because Dropbox annoyed me enough with the pop-ups telling me that it would no longer support the file system that I chose on my Linux computer. So I got this punched in the face the other day with a dialog box that says, oh, I can't sync until you sign in and move to a supported file system.
Because, in that voice?
Yeah, very much so. That's my new... micro voice. The nuts and bolts of it are it only supports ext4 on Linux, or that's what they say. And so that annoyed me, and I because my my laptop is installed with an XFS partition for home. And so I was chatting to Martin at the time and he said, well, you could try this. And so I tried the suggestion that he said, which is basically create an image file, format it, EXT4, copy all the Dropbox files in there and then mount it where Dropbox expects it to be. And so Dropbox just sees some stuff and thinks it's an EXT4 file system, which it is inside the image file. And it works. It works perfectly. I've had it like that for a week or more. And so I wrote a blog post detailing everything, how to do it. So if other people want to try and get around this stupid Dropbox limitation of which file system you are mandated to use. And it works. So
does it have any performance issues or other weird gotchas?
It's hard to know. Like, I sync one file every 2 weeks in Dropbox. I don't use Dropbox heavily. It's right. Like, so I doubt it, really.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny level of extra overhead having an EXT file system in a file on top of XFS. I don't think it's a big deal.
Loopback mounted. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I found when I was setting this up was I had to make the mount point immutable. So if it doesn't mount for any reason, this Dropbox doesn't start up and suddenly go, aha, you have no files. I would delete all of your files.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not what you want.
Yeah, yes. But Alan's captured all of those corner cases in his blog post.
I discovered recently that if you're running Nextcloud Sync client and it spots a situation like that, it pops up a box and says, I've noticed all of your files have been deleted locally. Do you want me to download them or do you want me to sync the deletion?
Okay. That's nice. Good. That's nice to know.
Cool.
Okay. A colleague of ours posted a blog called KDE Apps at the Snap of Your Fingers. And this was a write-up of the work that Igor had done with Harold Sitter, who works for Blue Systems, working on KDE Plasma. And the blog post outlines some stuff about how the KDE SDK for creating snaps is now available via a build snap and a content snap, and outlines some of the improvements that Harold has made to the CMake plugins for Snapcraft so they better suit KDE use cases, and that the aspiration now is for KDevelop to add these features and capabilities all integrated so you can use it to develop your KDE apps and spit out a snap all automatically. So as a result, I think there's about a dozen updated KDE snaps in the Snap Store and a whole bunch more in the pipeline.
I like the idea of having KDevelop, you know, if you having it as a first-class citizen. Like, if you're a new person getting involved in KDE and you want to develop an application and you choose Qt and you choose KDE as the platform you want to build for, that's what you want to target because it's got a rich set of APIs and a very friendly community. So you open up KDevelop and being able to develop an application and then press a button and out pops a snap that you can shove in the store and get to users within minutes. I think that is a compelling argument. Mm. I think that's a brilliant way to do the whole software life cycle for, you know, I want to get started developing a thing. I want to scratch an itch, develop a thing. And then I want other people to be able to access this thing, like straight from opening KDevelop all the way to getting it in the store. I know it's not there yet, but I love that as a whole concept from start to finish. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And then also, as a technology preview, the entire KDE Plasma desktop is available as a snap.
This was quite funny because nobody saw this coming. And then Harold was like, oh, by the way, I've made a snap of Plasma. We're like, what? Like,
which part?
Yeah, it was like, no, all of it. Which was quite funny. So, yeah, that was quite interesting. I like that.
And our friend of the show, Jason Evangelo, who's a Forbes contributor, has written about that on Forbes. And I've got that snap installed, but I haven't had the opportunity to try it out yet because I've been busy with work and now recording this podcast. So after this, I'm going to have a play because I can install KDE Plasma now and not have a whole bunch of, you know, random stuff deposited on my file system. It's terrific.
Great. More Ubuntu laptops are now available from Dell. So as of Friday, the developer editions of the Precision 5530 and 3530 mobile workstations are available with Ubuntu 18.04.
This was one of the laptops we reviewed earlier in the year, the new XPS 13. And I think at that time it still had 16.04 on it. And now they've refreshed all of this lineup to have 18.04.
Yeah, the wheels in Dell move a little bit slow sometimes. And, you know, they've had a bit of criticism that, you know, you buy a brand new laptop in mid to end 2018 and you get an operating system from 2 years ago on it. And that seems pretty common in Dell. They build an image and that's the thing that gets deployed to all these machines. And it's very hard to get them to move forward. And I'm sure there's good reasons for that, but it's great to see that they have now done the engineering, because obviously it's going to take some time and effort to build all the images for all those machines and QA them and make sure they're, and then have the support people able to support them. Because remember, if you buy a laptop and it's got 16.04 on it, it will have Unity. And if you buy a laptop that's got 18.04 on it, it's going to have GNOME Shell. And so the support people need to be able to support both. So it's not just a case of, oh, just upgrade them all and everything will be fine. There's certainly some effort that's been done there. It's great to see that they've moved forward.
Yeah, there's a quite a selection of laptops available from Dell now with Ubuntu preloaded.
Yeah. Martin, have we got any time for some Mir's Not Dead news?
I think we have. Let's squeeze in the last Mir's Not Dead news of 2018. So the Mir team post on the Ubuntu discourse, and they've said that they're doing the final cleanups for the Mir 1.1 release. This seems to be revolving around some of the NVIDIA driver support that they've been working on. I quite liked this. They had an issue where some of the background and splash screen spinners and stuff weren't working. And they've commented, I missed these because they've never worked on NVIDIA, so I forgot that they were things that existed. So those last pull requests are under review. And it goes on to say that they're hopeful for a before Christmas Mir 1.1 release.
Awesome.
Oh, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Very well done. And we've got one event as well. This is a little ways off, but the event is FOSS Talk Live. This is happening on the 8th of June, 2019 in London at the Harrison Pub. And if you've been listening to the podcast for a couple of years, you'll know that FOSS Talk Live is an evening of podcasts, hosted by Joe Ressington, and Late Night Linux will be there. Ubuntu Podcast will be there. I think Linux Lads, new podcast in Dublin, they're going to be joining us for the first time. And Maris Quebec is coming over, and Dave Mega Slippers from Geek News Radio will be joining as well. And Stuart Langridge from Bad Voltage. So there'll be an evening of podcasts. Book early to avoid disappointment. And that is all for the community news and events.
Are you listening to us on our Roku channel? Help other Roku users find the Ubuntu podcast and learn more about open source by giving our channel a star rating.
Right, and that wraps up episode 41. So this is it. This is the penultimate episode, right? Yeah. We're just about to enter the home straight before we take a break for a little bit, consider our future.
Do we have to remind everyone the way this works?
I think so. I think we should do a public service announcement.
Who's going to do that then?
The way this works is that at the end of every year, we take a break from doing the podcast, and then we get together, the three of us, and we have a curry, and we decide if we're going to do another season of the podcast the following year. As you have just heard, next year you're guaranteed exactly one podcast, which will be the one that happens at FOSS Talk Live in June. And if we decide to come back, we may do others as well. And this year we're going to do something a bit different, aren't we, Alan?
Yeah, we put out a call to see if anyone fancied doing a meetup. And obviously it's a bit difficult doing a meetup before Christmas because everyone's busy with Christmas parties and saving their pennies to buy mince pies, I guess. But in the new year, we're hoping to have a get together somewhere in the UK, where the three of us can go and you can join us, and maybe we could have a beer, maybe we could have a curry, maybe we could have a little old chit chat and, discuss Ubuntu, Linux, nerdy stuff, whatever. But just, an opportunity for us to get together and meet you people and you meet us.
So if you want to know when that's happening, you can either follow us on Twitter, because we'll be posting details there. So that's at Ubuntu Podcast on Twitter. Or you can come and join our Telegram channel, which is ubuntupodcast.org/telegram, where we're in there with hundreds of other listeners. And that's where you'll find out what our plans are and how you can get involved. And with that, see you next week for our predictions for 2019 and some command line love.